From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Lecture Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at hawaii.edu/CSEAS.
Welcome to the brown bag or colloquium or symposium. I'm not sure what it's turned into. We have a lot of people up here in front of us. But it's tentatively called Area Studies and Political Science, the Case of Southeast Asia. And my name is Ehito Kimura. I'm assistant professor in the Political Science Department. I'm a professed Southeast Asianist, and so I'm thrilled that we're having this particular session as it stands. And my main job today is going to be as moderator, keeping time and sort of taking questions and that kind of thing. But the panel itself is sponsored by the Center for Southeast Asian Studies, the Center for Philippine Studies, the Department of Political Science, and the East-West Center. So I'm glad we have a lot of people on board for this. And I just want to say a few seconds just about how we came to be in terms of this particular panel. I think there's a number of reasons why we thought it might be interesting to have this panel. One is the timely publication of the book entitled Southeast Asia in Political Science. And it's a book that I think challenges both area studies to look theoretically beyond their particular discipline and beyond their particular region, and also for a political scientist to take seriously the research taking place in Southeast Asia. And one thing I noticed about the title is it's Southeast Asia in Political Science, and not necessarily Southeast Asia and Political Science. And fortunately, it's not Southeast Asia or Political Science. But an intriguing, nonetheless, in terms of the proposition. Aside from the publication of the book, there's the good fortune of having one of the editors, one of the brainchilds of this entire project, Eric Kuhonta, here with us today. He's doing a fellowship at the East-West Center. And just by way of introduction, he is an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. He studied at Princeton University and has had fellowships at Stanford University, the National University of Singapore, and has published widely in journals in the field. We also have two authors of various chapters with us, fortunately. We have Professor Richard Doner, who is from Emory University. He studied at Stanford University, and his work focuses on the political economy of the institutional features of economic growth in Southeast Asia, and I think nicely captures some of our themes about looking outside of the region and within the discipline of political science. And then our other featured discussant is Professor Ben Kirkliet, who is a graduate affiliate now in the Department of Political Science, but was also a professor here for a decade or so before going on to Australian National University and heading the program there on the Department of Social and Political Change, as it were. And then lastly, we have the great fortune of having two really great discussants with us today. We have Professor Peter Manicus, and Peter is a professor of philosophy emeritus at Queen's College, and now here the director of interdisciplinary studies and professor of sociology here at the University of Hawaii. And I think will provide some really thoughtful remarks in terms of methodology and epistemology and those sorts of issues. And of course, Professor Barbara Andaya, who is, among many other things, the director of Southeast Asian Studies here, was formerly the president of AAS, the Association of Asian Studies. She studied at the University of Hawaii MA, which I did not know, actually, and got her PhD at Cornell University. And so that's all I will say in terms of introductions. I think the format that we agreed upon is to give Eric a few moments, maybe 5 or 10 minutes or so, to kind of place the context of the book, sort of either the genealogy of how it came to be and some ideas that he was grappling with, and then immediately really give the floor over to Professor Manikis and Professor Andaya to give their brief remarks, and then give an opportunity for some of the chapter writers, Professor Doner and Professor Kirkliot, to give some brief remarks, and then basically just to open it up to the floor and to encourage graduate students, faculty, anyone really that has any questions or insights or comments. And I think we'll probably try to collect a few comments and then bring them back to the panel. But if there are sort of pressing issues that you'd like to address, that would be great too. So that's the quick introduction. And the final thing I will say is that Southeast Asia in Political Science is actually a production of the East-West Center and Stanford University publication, Contemporary Issues in the Asia Pacific. They are selling copies here, I believe, and there's more information about the series here. Just as a personal plug, it's a great series, and I've assigned several books from the series itself in some of my classes, too. And so I highly encourage you to check out both the book, which I think all political scientists that do Southeast Asia should definitely read, and I would say people outside of political science and outside of Southeast Asia should also read. So I'll keep my remarks there, and I'll hand it over to Eric.
Thanks very much, Ehito, for your very kind endorsement of the book. Your observation about the preposition in the title is very apropos. We thought very hard about the title of this book, and in a sense, the agenda of the book is encapsulated very much in that preposition, Southeast Asia in political science. I want to first start by thanking Barbara and Hito for organizing this panel. The book just came out in fall 2008, so this colloquium, in effect, stands as a book launch, and we have books for sale here, so it's a real privilege to have this opportunity to do this in Hawaii. Secondly, I want to acknowledge two of my fellow panelists, Rick Doner and Ben Kirkfleet, who are authors of chapters in this book. It's very fortuitous that we're all here at the same time, which makes this panel possible. A number of the goals of this book that I'll discuss in a second are very nicely reflected in the works of Rick and Ben. So this is really an excellent opportunity to discuss the broader issues in this book in this forum. And finally, I want to acknowledge, as Ehito did, the East-West Center. The book is published under Stanford Press, but within the series Contemporary Issues in Asia and the Pacific. And this series, as Ehito has quite correctly noticed, is an excellent series. And this was my first choice to get this book in this series precisely because some of these books fulfill the goals of this project, which is looking at Southeast Asia through very sharp analytical lenses. So it's quite fortunate, again, to have this colloquium just a few steps away from the East-West Center. I want to just speak for about 10 minutes and give a context for this project and set the background for the discussion. And I've divided my comments into three parts. One is to discuss the origins of this project, the context for this book. Then secondly, look at the goals of this book, what we seek to do. And then thirdly, I will conclude by a few comments on where I hope this book will move the agenda, move the debate in terms of Southeast Asia and political science. First, in terms of the context of this project, this book is very much a product of debates within political science, particularly debates about qualitative methods and methodology more generally, and the theory. The co-editors of this book, myself, Dan Slater, and Tuong Vu, as junior scholars and even earlier as graduate students, have been grappling with these questions about theory and methodology in political science. And particularly as young scholars, these questions are very important. Not that many times, but a few times, we have found ourselves having to defend the kind of work that we do in political science conferences. And particularly the work that we do is qualitative. And by qualitative, we mean generally work that is narrative and in form, and that is based on either combination of fieldwork research, such as archival research, interviews, participant observation, but also more secondary work such as comparative historical analysis, a conceptual analysis, interpretivist analysis. So this is the grab bag collection of what we mean by qualitative methods. And this kind of research is sometimes challenged, criticized for being quote-unquote unscientific or for being rather vague. And so what we decided was that it would be best to actually assert a strong position on the value and benefits of qualitative methods, particularly in the context of Southeast Asian politics. That said, our intent in this project is not at all to rehash battles about methodology directly from the discipline, but rather our goal is more to clarify, to sharpen our position, and particularly the importance that we believe of qualitative methods in Southeast Asian politics, as well as the importance of area studies for knowledge accumulation in broader theories about comparative politics. And the best way we thought of doing this was to highlight the value of Southeast Asian research and show very explicitly how area studies, qualitative methods, and theories in comparative politics, how they this interplay of these three fields has led to significant research findings, not just in the field of Southeast Asia, but in the broader field of comparative politics. So that's the broad context of this project. Now, in terms of the goals of this book, there are three I want to just outline. First, the book provides a state-of-the-art review of the field of the literature in Southeast Asian politics. It does this thematically by examining literature on different key themes such as state structures, political parties, regimes, political economy, agrarian politics, contentious politics, civil society, religion, ethnicity, and globalization. And these reviews should provide a useful overview for students and scholars interested in the field, not just political scientists, but also anthropologists, sociologists, historians, and other scholars interested in Southeast Asian politics. And one point that a number of the chapters make is that a lot of the contributions in Southeast Asian political studies have not come just from political scientists, but also from other social scientists, especially anthropologists. The second goal of this book is a bit more ambitious, and here it goes back to my earlier comments. Here what we're trying to do is make a very strong case for the value of qualitative methods in area studies, especially as crucial pillars for theory building. The chapters are structured around one key question, and the question is this: to what extent has there been knowledge accumulation in the particular thematic question under study? And so the questions are meant to explore this theme of knowledge accumulation, particularly by situating the scholarship on Southeast Asian politics in terms of its contributions to broader questions in the comparative politics field. What the book seeks to assert, but above all to show very clearly through an overview of the literature, is that in fact knowledge accumulation has been advanced through this interplay of area studies, qualitative methods, and comparative theories in comparative politics. The take-home message of this book is this, that Southeast Asianists have made key contributions to our understanding of broader theories in comparative politics. I want to highlight just a few areas where research in Southeast Asia has been at the forefront of broader themes in comparative politics. And this research has been largely based in qualitative methods. One research program here in the 1970s was questions about peasant rebellion. And so the debate about the moral economy versus the rational peasant between Jim Scott and Sam Popkin has been very important and at the heart of comparative politics. A second related debate over weapons of the weak, everyday politics, the hidden transcript, these are all very, very powerful concepts, has also been advanced by by Southeast Asians, Jim Scott and Ben Kerbfleet, have been pushing this very important research agenda. The third research program that has been important, but it's now defunct, is the concept of bureaucratic polity. This was really a concept in the heyday of modernization and the political development, political system kind of literature in the 1960s. It's no longer really being read closely, but in its time, it was quite important. And I also want to highlight this concept of the bureaucratic polity because its author was, in fact, a professor here at UH, Fred Riggs. The debate over consociationalism, about the pros and cons of consociational democracy, is very much based on cases in Southeast Asia, particularly Malaysia. And this debate has gone back and forth between Donald Horwitz, who was just a visiting professor here at the law school, and Aaron Leipart. And then questions over ethnic politics, Lucien Pai, Clifford Geertz, and Furnival's concept of the plural society, these ideas have been quite influential in comparative politics and even beyond comparative politics. And then finally, a work that needs really no comment is Ben Anderson's seminal work on imagined communities, whose vast influence goes much beyond any disciplinary boundaries. So here you see just a few of the most prominent ways that Southeast Asians have been at the forefront of key debates in comparative politics, and particularly using the vast armory of qualitative methods. And finally, the third goal of this project has been not just to showcase the value of Southeast Asian political studies, but also to make a call for a more explicit effort to link area studies with comparative politics through a more theoretical lens. The book does make a claim that comparative politics and area studies are deeply complementary. We make that argument. But at the same time, we also argue that more efforts can be made by area studies work to make the research engage comparative politics much more forcefully. In other words, we believe that sometimes, not always, but sometimes Southeast Asian research does not make as much of an impact on comparative politics as it should, because researchers have not framed their work in theoretical or conceptual terms. So we argue that this is crucial if we want to attract a broader audience. And this can be done in three ways. One is to embed one's case study in more comparative analysis, either doing this explicitly or implicitly. Secondly, this can be done by engaging more directly, more forcefully with the theoretical literature itself. And thirdly, this can also be done by making one's causal arguments much more precise, much more explicit, rather than leaving them implicit and sort of hidden in the text itself. One of the criticisms often made of area studies is that this work tends to be kind of vague. Yes, they're trying to explain something, but they're never quite clear about what they're trying to explain. And we argue that the way around this, this criticism is to be very precise in defining one's causal argument. And finally, the role of comparative analysis is one major refrain that runs throughout almost every chapter in this book. We are strong proponents of the value of comparative analysis, largely because it provides the best means for researchers to engage in both some aspect of generalization while also still remaining faithful to our interest in the cases as cases. And this goes back to the arguments made by Robert Merton, by the sociologist Robert Merton and Giovanni Sartori, that the middle level of generalization is a very appropriate area for theory building, precisely because it allows for cases and some abstraction to work themselves out. And lastly, I just want to conclude by making a few remarks about where I hope this book will move debate, how it will move people to think about these issues. First, I hope, and here I'm really talking to graduate students, I hope this book will excite graduate students about the depth and breadth of the field of Southeast Asian politics. What really matters, I believe, in academia is to be passionate about a particular subject that we study. And what this book shows is that there is a lot to be passionate about in Southeast Asian political studies. Secondly, I hope this book reinforces in the minds of graduate students the value of qualitative analysis, and that this kind of research, this qualitative research, deserves to be pursued, it deserves to be strengthened, it deserves to be showcased, and all of this despite recurring fads of quantification that pervade the discipline. And thirdly, I hope this book makes young researchers proud of being Southeast Asianists, not just because of the personal value that is inherent in the work that we do, but also because in the yardstick of knowledge accumulation, which is the ultimate sign of progress in the social sciences, our field has done quite well.
All right. Thank you very much for those remarks. I think we'll just move ahead with Professor Menendez.
Okay.
Sure.
Good. Well, let me say first, I'm very pleased to have been invited to this panel, because I do think the volume does represent some very healthy developments in social science more generally, not just political science or Asian studies or Southeast Asian studies, but area studies, but in social science more generally. I think it's a useful effort on the part of all the authors to bring in dimensions which are often, I think, slighted. So let me note that following the very useful introduction of the volume, I'm going to group my remarks into three basic headings: comparative politics and area studies, the role of nature theory, and then the pertinence of qualitative work. It's true, I think, that the studies, that area studies and comparative politics are complementary rather than antagonistic. The reasons for this are best seen in the debate over theory, as the editors say. But let me first note that some 9 years ago, I was a participant in a panel stage here at Manoa entitled The Future of Area Studies. At that time, the central question for me was whether area studies could overcome the damage done by historically constituted disciplinary approaches. With some idealization, the picture as I saw it then and still see it, more or less, is as follows. As was clear to the founders of the disciplines of the social sciences, if inquiry was to be scientific, claim authority, and funding from aid and other funding agencies, it had to be scientific. And as in the already established physical sciences, inquiry therefore had to be divided into various distinct and largely autonomous disciplines: psychology, anthropology, sociology, political science, economics. Second, since the human sciences, like the physical sciences, are nomothetic, not ideographic, all of these would be separated from history. Third, as these general laws must be empirical, they must be empirical, but preferably in the form of empirically discovered functions and regularities, preferably quantitative. At some level of abstraction, there would be laws pertinent to the economies, for example, supply and demand, others pertinent to the social system, for example, regularities of group behavior, family function, the function, and of course, those which bear on the political order, for example, the iron law of oligarchy, which is a perfect example. This would explain and predict by showing that outcomes were deducible from the discovered laws and theories. Hypotheses would be put forward and tested, all would be objective, rigorous, scientific. This division of labor allowed historians and humanists to go their own separate ways. History would be narrative, was still subject to the test of evidence, but need not be theoretical. Meanwhile, the humanist studies, for example, oriental studies, ethnographies of exotic groups, would be descriptive, legitimately unscientific, perhaps even legitimately antiquarian, relativist, and subjectivist. Am I going too fast? Probably. I was going to try to do this without reading my text, but I'm no Barack Obama. How does this?
I knew Barack Obama.
Okay. As I saw, given these very strong assumptions about the nature of human science, putting an economist on the same floor as a humanist allowed for some mystification, but perhaps little else. Already in 1958, C. Wright Mills had it right. Grand theory and abstracted empiricism had not been exercised. The essays in this present volume suggest that the exorcism is in process. The two key themes, then, that I want to show this is in terms of theory and the pertinence of qualitative work. Theory is a messy term. We need here to distinguish, at the very least, general theory and concrete theory. Structural functionalism, Marxism, at least in its textbook form, rational choice theory are general theories. But two are a host of general theories about modernization, development, democratization, and revolution. They are meant to apply everywhere and everywhen. By contrast, perhaps what Merton called, and Satori following, middle-range theories are meant to apply concretely and hence historically. A proper reading of Weber is the dominating figure for this view, as noticed by C. Wright Mills. I could really go on lengthily about Weber's views on all these matters, which I think are often misunderstood, but he remains, I think, a great source for this whole discussion. Frankly, I think Weber is still... And, of course, some of the students of Weber are among advances as well, not all. Anyway, on this view, then, the proper rationale for comparative work and for area studies is not to search for explanatory generalizations, but to get an understanding of a concrete place by sharpening and recognition of differences, despite similarities and analogies. So the theory here enters, you see, in comparative theory enters, you see, so to see as much the case study as covering under an abstraction, but not reducible to it, as you quite rightly pointed out, I think. But the full force of this approach can be seen in the context of explanation, particularly in the contrast between showing that some outcome is an instance of a regularity and understanding why the regularity is what is discovered to be. The regularity, the generalization, if you will, salt tends to dissolve in water, is of very little scientific interest. People knew this before we had molecular chemistry. But with this body of theory, we get an understanding of an immense number of generalizations about the regularities of ordinary life. Social scientific theory plays the same role, but there is a key difference. There's a typo in my text there, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. I said there is no key difference, and I meant to say there is a key difference, and of course that's very misleading. But there is a key difference between natural scientific theory and social theory. That difference being the fact that the causes are the actions of ordinary people in their ordinary lives, and of causal mechanisms, historically constituted social mechanisms, which produce the outcome they do because of the actions of people, each of whom is acting with materials at hand. And of course, that's just a kind of paraphrase of a text from the 18th Brumaire, which all of you will know, how we make history, but not with materials of our own choosing. Accordingly, unlike the causal mechanism of nature, these materials are historically constituted, concrete, and changing. Theories about these causal mechanisms must accordingly be concrete, time and space specific. As our editors write, unlike most positive quantitative analysis, interpretists believe that the ultimate goal of social science is not to search for causal regularities, but to understand social phenomena, which I've just tried to say in my own words. I think that's correct and true. I think that in some sense or other, a lot of writers in this book see that. Which is to say, broadly speaking, that they've certainly rejected any kind of positivist view of science, any kind of positivist view of theory, and any kind of positive view of quantitative methods. So they're now, they've opened the door for a very different concept of social science, in my view. A social science which is multidisciplinary, multi-level, and non-reductionistic, involving political economy and culture, involving politics and sociology, involving anthropology, ethnicity, race, and all the rest. Okay. Qualitative inquiry, then. To understand outcomes, we need qualitative work. And again, I think of qualitative work in the way that you suggested it earlier. Right? It includes not just simply immersion in a field study, but also any kind of archival work, any kind of work having to do with meaning and belief, any kind of work that sheds light upon what people believe and think and feel at any given time and place in history. We need to know what actors do and why they do it. We need to know what they believe about God, politics, work, race, and family. We need to have a clear grasp of what enables and constrains them, whether or not they are themselves aware or unclear about the conditions of action. We need to identify the unintended consequences of the conjoined action. We need to determine whether what is believed is true. Indeed, some outcomes require that actors have false beliefs. All of this requires concrete theory. Exactly how the inquiry proceeds will depend upon the theoretical position taken vis-a-vis the problem under study. Thus, well, I'm not going to skip that. I have a short section in which I go through the book and try to find a bunch of examples of work that I think, in fact, a sense to what I'm essentially saying, although I'm not clear about that, as I'll suggest to you also in a moment. Because it's not clear to me whether our editors or the authors in this volume would entirely go along with my way of speaking about their work. For example, I'm uncomfortable with the term interpretives, which usually identifies writers who reject entirely causal analysis in the human sciences. The tension perhaps results from difficulties with the term cause. There are the differences between a kind of Humean constant conjunction conception of cause, whenever this, then that, and a more healthy, productive powers conception of cause, in which agents are causes, things have powerful particulars, have causal powers. That's a very different conception. It seems to me it's the only conception that's viable for any science, not just a human science. But I can't elaborate on that, I must say, in this brief time that I've got. Okay. I find tensions in some of the essays, which in part at least would seem to be a product of methodological pluralism, strongly defended by Emerson toward the end of the volume. I mean, there's a kind of nice, good feeling about your comrades that, you know, let them do their thing and I'll do my thing and everybody will live happily after. But it seems to me there are some things that are done in social science that just should be rejected, period. Well, one of the main ones being the idea that I can explain by use of generalization. Generalizations do not explain. They need explaining. I'm going to say that about six times in different ways. The worst case of this, of course, is a student of Barrington Moore's, Theda Scotchpole, in her States and Social Relations. So absolutely the worst case of an effort on part of social science is to be scientific by Hopper, you can explain a social revolution in three countries by means of generalizations. Total nonsense. Which she, by the way, has now ascended to many years ago. She gave up on that idea many years ago. Again, it's kind of ironical in a sense because she quite rightly points out that Barrington Moore should have been her model. And if you want a model for me, for what I'm saying, Barrington Moore's Origins of Dictatorship Democracy remains a classic text, comparative politics and area studies, both in an integrative kind of a way. In any case, so the problem is not whether there's a place for quantitative work. Of course, there's not a question whether or not we need numbers, we need facts, we need the data that even a multiple regression can give us. Because a regression can give us some information that we wouldn't have had otherwise. That information, however, again, needs to be explained. That's the point. It's descriptive. So you have descriptive qualitative, you have descriptive quantitative, and now you have explanatory. Explanatory means, what are the causes? The causes involve what are people doing, and why are they doing it, and what are the social mechanisms involved in their doing what they're doing, such that the outcome is what it is. Again, I find lots of examples of that in the book we're looking at, and I hope I can be encouraged that my two authors here, Eric Mr. Doner and Ben, who's an old colleague. Ben and I started this argument about 20 years ago. From Scotch Bowl.
That's right.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, I hope that my colleagues here on the panel will endorse some of what I'm saying as in some ways helpful. It's more radical, I think, than some of them want to be, but that's okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think it does raise sort of fundamental questions about how we think about social science, and you talked about how social science and humanities have gone different kinds of directions. And so I think then in some ways it's appropriate that we have a perspective from the quote humanities from Barbara on diet.
Absolutely.
Well, I accepted this invitation at a very weak moment. I need a T-shirt that says no. So I don't hold out any great hopes of illuminating discussions. But I'd like to pick up on some of the comments that Professor Manikas has made. But the first thing I'd like to say is this book, as you know, Southeast Asia in Political Science Theory, Region and Qualitative Analysis, is what my old professor at Cornell would have called an honest title. It does tell you what the book is like, and I very much appreciated its accessibility, its lack of jargon, the fact that a mere historian could read this and appreciate what was going on. And I'd also like to congratulate the editors, because I know how difficult it is to put a multi-authored book together. But I don't intend, in the time that I've got available, I don't really want to talk about individual essays. What I want to do is to consider some of the issues raised in the book, and particularly by the editors and their conception of what they were doing, in relation to the interplay between region and discipline as it applies to history. And I think the historical discipline is rather different from political science, in the sense that still today it's remained rather sympathetic to the concept of world areas and specialization in world areas. And that has important implications for the interaction between historians themselves. And if you look at our history department as a typical example, people concentrate on an area of the world usually. They might take a course in world history, they might have minors, but they are specializing in Chinese history or Japanese history or, in our case, Southeast Asian history. And so, in general, I would say, rather than, as Isaiah Berlin talked about political science, I'm going to look at you all with greater respect, and he talked about the political science field as divided into foxes and hedgehogs. And foxes are those who prefer to concentrate their intellectual efforts on the details of a particular region, and hedgehogs are those who advocate universal theory and abstraction. I'm not quite sure why he chose foxes and the hedgehogs. I would say in history generally, we don't have foxes and hedgehogs, because I think what the preservation of area studies as within history departments has done has generated a kind of a mutual respect for those people who can use sources, who have the language skills and have the historical instinct that we may not have in our we may not have except in our relation to our particular area. But nonetheless, and this is particularly in relation to this honest title, Southeast Asian Political Science, Southeast Asianists in history do face an issue, because while Western Europe, Africa, the Middle East have been generally accepted as areas that you can specialize in, still today, 60 years after the first Centers for Southeast Asian Studies were established in the United States, the question of is there a Southeast Asia, is it a coherent region, is still being debated. In fact, one of the contributors to this book, Don Emerson, made two important contributions to that debate in the 1980s, in his 1980 article on the value of a maritime perspective in Southeast Asia, which is still, even in Vietnam, it's actually generated recently some interesting discussion, and in his 1984 article, when he talked about what's in a name, and he addressed ASEAN, a very small ASEAN as it was at that stage. Now, one would assume that by now the issue would have been settled. And for the authors of this book, Southeast Asia is a given. It's not something that they're questioning. But for historians, recent work by Victor Lieberman will generate yet another round of discussion about the coherence of Southeast Asia, and particularly the interrelationship between mainland Southeast Asia and island Southeast Asia. And that brings me to the point that Professor Manukas made, and which concerns the feasibility of generalizations. If Southeast Asia has difficulties, it is with this question of generalization. And this is something, the question of generalization is something with which this book is specifically concerned. And because historians have generally placed such enormous emphasis on linguistic skills and cultural knowledge, it makes the average historian extremely nervous about venturing into an area where they don't have those skills. So would any of us say anything about Africa? Not likely. We don't know those languages. We don't know those cultures very well. So although some historians, notably Tony Reid, but others as well, and including myself and Bennett too, have been committed Southeast Asians, you might say. People like Tony Reid have been at the forefront of those advocating a region. Nonetheless, the thematic approach, the kind of issues that you see in this book, where chapters are devoted to matters like democracy, civil society, that kind of thematic approach is actually quite rare among historians. And it's rare because as soon as you start exploring a theme across the region, you are laying yourself open to criticism from your fellows, whom you respect, that your generalizations lack depth, that you don't have the linguistic skills to make, or the cultural knowledge to make these kinds of comments. And also because the historical discipline gives enormous value to the single-authored monograph. Perhaps more so than in almost any other discipline, there is a hierarchy of scholarship. And articles, essays may be very good, may be very interesting, but they're down the list. So it's very hard to maintain a thematic idea over 300 pages. Maybe you can do it in 25 or 30. But although historians would all agree, like the authors of this book, that Southeast Asia is a splendid site for comparative thinking, the kind of producing a single-authored monograph of this size on a particular theme is not easy because of the emphasis placed on source knowledge. And then just a couple more points. One of the plaints of Southeast Asianists, I'm sure I speak to my fellows as well, is that Southeast Asia is almost invariably overlooked when global audiences are under consideration. And social scientists have said, well, this is because we, area studies lack theoretical strength, and we fail to engage with comparative work. And the contributors to this book address that question, and very well indeed. Historians also bemoan this marginalization, and of course then they, with some caveats, welcome work like Tony Reed's Southeast Asia in the Age of Commerce or Victor Lieberman's Strange Parallels, because they address the larger academy, because they address a larger audience than simply Southeast Asianists. And when you saw something like Southeast Asia in the Age of Commerce being reviewed in the New York Review of Books, that is a rare occurrence for a work on Southeast Asia. But at the very same time as they welcome those kinds of, they also say, well, it doesn't hold in my area. I'm not in Vietnam in the 16th century or wherever. And that's good, because it spawns more work, like Nguyen Tran on Vietnam has actually questioned the idea that women in Vietnam had high status in earlier times. And it also raises the issue, though, of whether the production of these works actually makes a difference to this great new and growing field of world history. Once long ago, it was called Western Civ, and it's now metamorphosed into work, and healthily so. But Southeast Asia can only get in there with maybe 15 minutes of lecture 16. Southeast Asia can only get in there if it produces a generalization that could be somehow applied in this world history framework. And that's precisely what Southeast Asianists don't like doing because of the diversity of the region. So generalizations have not been a feature of knowledge production, and probably rightly so, in historical scholarships. And yet, of course, this is, in a sense, as I said, necessary if we're going to enter into that global arena of world history. And finally, and this is most my final comment, that in contrast to political science, the book Eric and his co-editors make this point, that political science work should and can influence the crafting of policy. And that raises again for historians the old bugbear of relevance, which we've, in different terminology, we've been talking about since the 1960s and earlier. Especially, of course, if you work on topics that relate to very early times or on subjects that have apparently very few parallels or conjunctions with the present. History, for many people, is only valuable if it provides a usable past. So if you do not work on something that is perceived as a usable past, that creates problems. And although I learned much from this book, I think it's a great book and I will certainly use it in my courses, one of the great problems for historians, that is for our Southeast Asian fellows and the social scientists, the concept of history is rather shallow. History, for most social scientists, is 100 years ago. That's old history. And I certainly agree with the editors that this is a time now, is a time when global events have reinforced the salience of area studies knowledge. But for historians, one of the key problems in promoting our field is the question of whether what we do is useful. And what can we legitimately say about the source material, whether in Southeast Asia the creation of a coherent narrative, a regional story, in a highly complex part of the world, does this adequately convey the messiness of historical processes? Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. I think there were some very thought-provoking sort of comments. The one that sort of that stood out to me was also when you mentioned at the last point about the humanities, there was a story in the New York Times recently about how humanities programs in undergraduate universities are having to defend themselves during these times of economic crisis and so on. But there were a lot of other themes that came out as well. But I thought I would give our two esteemed chapter authors also a brief time to respond to some of the comments or any thoughts that they had. And then the audience who's been so patient maybe could also put forth some questions or comments about what's been said as well. But should we go ahead and start with Ben Kirk? Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you all panelists for your comments. I know that there are political science departments that are divided between foxes and hedgehogs. And I know that political science and area studies as fields of study can be stressful, strained, even non-existent. I know this from what I read about some universities and hear from colleagues in various universities in the United States. But one thing that's given me pause thinking about what I would say today and thinking back on Eric and other co-editors' project and my involvement is to note that I have personally not felt this. In my own experience of teaching at the University of Hawaii or for nearly 20 years and then more recently for almost 17 years at Australian National University. In those departments, those universities, I have not experienced prejudice or disparaging remarks for publishing in, quote, area journals rather than, quote, discipline journals. I have not seen junior faculty members pressured to publish only in political science journals. And I have not seen bitter and divisive cleavages among faculty members over area studies approaches or even over qualitative, quantitative kinds of methodological approaches to the study of politics. On the contrary, in my experience at these two places, Hawaii and Australia National, I've seen appreciation for scholarship that emphasizes particular parts of the world, particular countries, that use qualitative methods, that combines empirical research and theory. Such appreciation has come not only from those colleagues who do that kind of work, but also from people who don't, the theorists, the pure theorists, even the number crunchers, and the quantitative, the advocates of quantitative analysis. So the question is, what makes the University of Hawaii political science, at least in my experience, and the Australian National University political science different from what I understand to be the case in many other parts of the United States? Maybe those other parts of other institutions in the United States where these tensions do exist and are real and are felt by individuals in some very direct and harmful ways are a very small proportion of the field. I'm not sure. But let me think a little bit out loud about the University of Hawaii. Maybe one of the explanations for the experiences that I've had here has to do with where we are in Hawaii, middle of the Pacific, a multicultural environment that you can see every day of your life, has had an influence on the way in which not only the university is put together, but the way politics is thought about and how to study it. Maybe another factor is that Hawaii and political science department at the University of Hawaii is physically removed. We're on the periphery of the center, or the big centers of political science are far away, out of mind, out of sight kind of thing. And not so directly affected by the ebbs and flows of debates over behavioralism and quantitative analysis and rational choice that have affected the discipline over the last several decades. I think part of it also goes to the way in which leadership in the political science department at the University of Hawaii have approached their role as chairmen and chairwomen, in which whatever their own particular orientation has been has, again, in my experience, been encouraging of a diversity rather than focusing on a few ways in which the discipline, political science, should be done. At the university, at Australian National University, I think part of the explanation has to do with the way in which the university was constructed in after World War II. From the very beginning, Australian National University had an abiding interest in its neighbors, its neighborhood, as it's sometimes referred to, meaning Pacific countries lying to the north, east, and Asian countries lying north and northwest. Indeed, when Australian National University started, it included a half a dozen what were called research schools. All but one of them were in the natural sciences, chemistry, medicine, physics, etc. There was one in what we could call social sciences and humanities, and it was called the Research School of Pacific Studies, later renamed the Research School of Pacific and Asian Studies. This, I think, reflects the university's commitment to area studies. And political science at the Australian National University has its roots, I would say, more in Great Britain than in the United States. Indeed, we don't hear much at that university about tensions between area studies and political science, between quantitative analysis and qualitative analysis. Not only don't I hear it at that university, but I don't hear it reported by colleagues in other universities in Australia. Indeed, one could say that the debates and struggles over staff appointment, curriculum, funding, and other resources rarely turn, so far as I can understand it, in other Australian universities. You do not turn on methodological issues or approaches or country expertise or the lack thereof. Even, I notice, economics departments, which I sometimes think of as the quintessential advocates of theory building, deductive analysis, and quantitative analysis, even economics departments in many Australian universities have economists who are specialists on particular countries and parts of the region and parts of the world, regional studies. Speaking of Great Britain, I'm told by some political science friends there that the tensions and animosities between the discipline and area studies that are felt in many United States universities rarely, if ever, occur in British universities. Political scientists I know in the Netherlands, Germany, the Philippines, Thailand, and Malaysia say much the same thing. I'm tempted to say that the problem seems to be largely a U.S. one, or maybe a North American one, although Eric can comment whether it includes Canada. If the conflict between political science and area studies is primarily a U.S. phenomenon, the obvious question is why. The answers lay apparently not in the discipline, generally, but in how the discipline has developed in the United States, or more specifically, in particular academic institutions in the United States that have considerable leverage and power in the organizations of the discipline, the American Political Science Association, the journal that the association publishes, and so on. I haven't really delved into this question, so I don't know the answers. Peter Manicus, who has the history of social sciences as one of his many specialties, has enlightened us to some extent in some of his remarks today and some of his publications. And part of the answer then seems to be a persistent, though not always dominant, theme in American political science since around the 1930s a theme to be a, quote, scientific discipline a la the natural sciences. This theme seems not to be so prominent in political science circles throughout the United States or in many other parts of the world.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think those were very thoughtful and appropriate kinds of comments given where we are. And I would echo those comments to some degree as well, that at this university, I haven't felt that same kind of tension that you might feel at an annual meeting or in other departments, perhaps.
But last but not least, I'd like to hand over the floor to Professor Richard Doner for a few moments.
Okay, great. First, a couple of introductory remarks. One is that Hito said that he was a professed Southeast Asianist, so it raises the possibility that there are lapsed political Southeast Asianists, and that we need some kind of intermediate category, such as a theoretically engaged. I'm not sure if what the appropriate Catholic parallel would be, but you know, it would probably be useful to find one. Second, preface point is just in. I very much appreciated Ben's comments just now, both substantively and also methodologically, because what he did there, if you see, was engaged in a controlled comparison. We have a puzzle. Some places are more eclectic, ecumenical. Others are more divided, hegemonic. How do we explain this cross-national comparison? It may have something to do with neighborhood effects, periphery, but essentially what I think you were doing was engaged in precisely the kinds of comparative analysis that the book calls for us to do. A couple of points on the addition to what Eric said about the functions of the book. I think first of all, it's a defensive move. It's a defensive catalog of what we've done, and it's a good thing, and we've made our contributions. Second, it's kind of a prescriptive exhortation to our younger colleagues. You can do this. You need to do it. You need to get engaged, right? And third, it's an effort to empower that engagement. How do you empower that engagement? One is by directly challenging Southeast Asianists to situate themselves in kind of methodologically in the process of knowledge accumulation. And to highlight the fact that there are a lot of points of entry. Are you generating a hypothesis? Are you generating a new concept? Are you figuring out how to maybe operationalize and measure a concept? Have you identified a new puzzle that nobody's really addressed before? Are you going beyond causal effects to get into the question that raised Professor Manicus on causal mechanisms, right? And can you justify why you have your cases? Why are you studying Cambodia, and what's the benefit of that? Another thing I think it tries to do, is to recognize the benefits of what we call contingent generalization. And here I want to take exception with the way this term generalization has been discussed. It's either you generalize or you don't generalize. But I think the benefits of area studies is to identify subpopulations of cases in which you could say, there seems to be a pattern of variation across these kinds of countries with these kinds of characteristics. One doesn't have to either be a fox or a hedgehog. And again, I think we need some kind of new category. I also think that it challenges and helps, hopefully empowers other scholars to reconcile in-depth study, highly in-depth study, including the study of history, with more comparative work. And here, the emphasis is on what I think is very, very useful work on historical institutionalism, which talks about where institutions come from, how sticky they are, how can they be changed, but where they come from. We take that seriously. And also, I hope that it empowers our colleagues, myself and other qualitative-oriented researchers, to engage and confront challenges from quantitative and formal theorists, right? The challenges are going to be there. Certainly in my university and many places they are. And they're going to be more in Southeast Asia because there's going to be more data sets. And when there's more data sets, people are going to grab onto them, and it's going to be really cool, and they can run the regressions, and it's going to feel really good, like you've nailed it, right? There is now an increasing literature on multi-methods. How does qualitative methods address and improve and build on other forms of methods, other methodological approaches? Now, this question of challenge is important, challenge from other methodological traditions, because, as Eric said, this is one place where the book originated. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, more very specifically, that Eric and I and Dansley, not very well explained, the variation is compelling on all kinds of questions, economic development, democratization, what have you. Also, there are now significant substantive issues that demand analysis, and they demand serious systematic analysis, whether it's urbanization, whether it's moderate Islam, whether it's secessionism, migration and new diseases. These are things that, if we're responsible social scientists, we have to deal with. Okay, a couple other points, and then I'll stop. One is, I would encourage you to think about the comparison of what we go through as Southeast Asians with what Latin Americans go through. Because typically, my understanding is Latin Americans have not gone through this breastfeeding and concern. Where do we fit in? Are we good enough? You know, are we really an area? It's not been an issue. And I think in general, there's been much more consistent and systematic and constructive engagement by Latin Americanists and at least political science and sociology. And the question is why? And I don't know the answer, but a couple of ideas. One is I think that there has been, and this some of you may take, and I hope you will take, productive difference with me, and that is there has been more robust indigenous theorizing in Latin America than there has been in Southeast Asia. Now, I would just, people may take umbrage at that. And why is that? Why is that? And maybe one of the reasons is that Latin America experienced greater levels of industrialization pre-World War II and then after World War II, certainly in the 80s, became somewhat of a basket case. Whereas Southeast Asia, to some degree, had a smoother transition, to some degree, an economic trajectory in which there wasn't as much demand for self-reflection, except in one part of Southeast Asia, also known, quote, as the Latin America of Southeast Asia, which is the Philippines, of course. And so when I think of some of the most important theorizing, self-conscious theorizing, I think it comes from the Philippines for the same reason that I think it comes from Latin America. Okay, let me conclude. Some obstacles to further improvements in the engagement. Obviously, there are some often nasty differences within political science departments. I have not experienced that in my department at Emory, but what I have experienced is challenge to be systematic. And so we used to complain that there's not enough training qualitatively of graduate students in our department. They said, fine, put up or shut up, teach a graduate seminar on qualitative methods. And I think that's exactly the right, and that's exactly the right challenge. There is a second obstacle, and that is the lack of codification of how to do qualitative work. And in this, I think the book could have done a better job. If you want to run regressions, if you want to do formal theory, game theory, you can pull books out. You know, there's all these handbooks about how to do this stuff. Only in the last 5 years now is there a systematic discussion of how to select a case. That's a fairly significant thing, right? And the last point is resistance from within area studies. Okay, and one of the factors. Has to do with the influence of the humanities. Another has to do with the relative cost of getting up to snuff with both language and historical understanding on the one hand and other kinds of capacities. And then finally, there's just that we love the place. And my last point is that I don't know if Ben remembers this or Eric remembers this, but we had a workshop that led to the book at Stanford, and I kind of was playing somewhat of the kind of methods devil's advocate. And I said, what I think the way we ought to train graduate students is to drop proper names. Think about your research without proper names. And I remember Don went, how could you say that? And I think Ben, you were a little appalled too. Other people were appalled. But that's what I tell my graduate students, especially those who are into Southeast Asia. What is your focus a case of? It's a phenomenon. I don't care about Thailand. I want you to stop thinking about Thailand, even though that's what I work on. I want you to think Thailand is a case of what? So, challenges, could you imagine doing your work without proper names?
All right. Thank you very much for those remarks, and thank you to everyone on the panel. I think we've had really interesting perspectives from every single panelist and raising all sorts of questions. You know, one issue that came to my mind, we've talked about, how do we think about social science? And you know, this is something that's often discussed in political science classes, but Is it that Southeast Asianists in some ways are hostage to a particular way of thinking of social science, or is it that actually a lot of the qualitative Southeast Asian research and political science has actually been as scientific, if not more so in some ways, because they've looked at certain aspects of causal mechanisms and so on? So there may be some these sorts of tensions, I think, were raised when I heard a lot of this, the comments, issues of variation, and whether there are deep differences within Southeast Asia. Is that something that prevents us from looking widely across the region, or is it something that's an opportunity to look at a lot of different places and therefore try to make broader generalizations and so on? But I'm not going to say anything more. The audience has been quite patient, and I would encourage anyone that has sort of questions or issues to more than speak up, ask questions, and so on. And I think maybe we could take a few comments and then give the panelists time to respond. And I see Belinda with her hand raised.
I have to leave, but I want to make a brief comment, mm-hmm. And maybe a question to Barbara later. But I'm glad Ben pointed out this international variation, because in Japan, for instance, I was there for a year, they liked media studies better than political science. If I was looking for the political science department, what I'm in Kansai University, where I was for the summer, and they didn't have any, you know, maybe political studies or international studies and so on. So I tend to agree with him that this might be an American Midwest East Coast problem. I remember that one of the manifestos I signed was when a group of political scientists who were doing media studies were very angry and terminated their subscription to the APSR. Okay, I don't know if you remember that, the American Political Science Review, because they couldn't read it anymore. You know, it's all math and figures and so on and so forth. And they had a movement passing around petitions to protest this kind of thing. Anyway, that's just a comment. And maybe Barbara, part of the reason we don't have a coherent Southeast Asia is its diversity. Mm. And maybe we want to have a coherent narrative. You know that kind of contradiction? I had two students at least who asked me where Southeast Asia was as a country. You know, I used to open Southeast Asia, and what country is that?
Should we collect a few more comments? Yeah, go ahead.
This is a terrific panel. I just wish there were more students of Southeast Asia here rather than students of political science or people who are both. Because there's a wonderful message between the bookends of Barbara and Eric. And that is, you've got to, as students, it's fine to be specialists, but you've got to know something outside your own specialty. And there's a great deal of resistance. I've known 40 years I've been doing this here. There has been a progression over the years from when Ben Kirkfleet was one of our students to present time, willingness to go outside of where you are and look at some other things. I remember being broadly rebuffed by a student who was doing a doctorate on Vietnam and had discovered some phenomena. I said, you know, if you read Virgil's Aeneid, you'll find that is the thing that you are discovering there is right in the propaganda that Virgil was making for Octavian. And I got to look like, what? You expect me to read classical history? What? That's not Southeast Asia. And I thought to myself, oh God, we're kind of losing the our heads. We're going into our little narrowness. And so I was really pleased to hear what was said here, and I wish we could take this message to our students. That's all I wanted.
All right, any other comments? Yes.
I appreciate part of the presentations that I heard. strikes me that, that one of the cautions that I heard that I think is worth emphasizing is, you know, getting beyond the false counterposition between qualitative and quantitative methods, and getting beyond the particular error that some political scientists have made with a particular model of science, and emphasizing the importance of conceptual rigor, conceptual clarity, from whatever level of analysis people do in the research. I like that part of what I heard. The other thing in terms of epistemic communities of scholars that I think do share and have shared some of the things that, that I hear, and I suspect I'll probably find them in the footnotes of the book anyway, but by way of emphasizing another point that I agree with, I mean, Barbara Guedes at UCLA is a good example of a Latin Americanist for 15, 20 years who's been saying some of the same kinds of things with her work about cases, paradigms, and sandcastles. And people may not agree with her fully, but it's less important to her whether you're using qualitative or quantitative research. But the conceptual rigor and the conceptual clarity, along with her people like, you know, I think David Collier, a lot of his work, and Charles Reagan, our AGIN, I think their work is essential, and the rigor with which they drive, and the force with which they drive themselves to be as conceptually clear as they can be, I think suggests that there are allies out there for people, you know, and that it's really worth, if you haven't been reading their work, I would consider it fundamental and essential. I'll have to read the book. Thank you for the presentation.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the comments, too. Yes, Leonard.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, basically, what we all have here in both, say, the social sciences as well as the humanities, is that you have different kinds of approaches. And it doesn't mean that one is better than the other. And we've always said, even in Southeast Asia, that you have these specialists. But the synthesis will, synthesize will not be able to do it without that kind of specialist knowledge. And then you get these modern historians, and you got these very early historians. I would hope that political science would have also this kind of range of different kinds of expertise, so that together would really be able to approach some type of a better understanding of whatever the problem is that's being focused on. Because one of the things that I think a lot of these cleometricians, those in history as well, who work on statistics and geometrics, what they've been focusing on is the idea that if we have enough statistics that will come closer to the truth, then this kind of idea type of approach where you feel this is the case because you have certain examples and this will make it an adequate generalization. And this may be exactly the same kind of problem that is coming up in the U.S., whether a lot of these people who are focusing on statistics are those who are under pressure from scientists saying, you know, prove that your discipline is worthwhile enough. Whereas, you know, the others don't think about that. I don't think they feel that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no.
Just real quick, I mean, I agree with that. I think what we're saying is probably dealing with because, and then also at another level, being multi-methods, one has to sort of experiment with different methods before one can figure out which one goes best with the problem. And then lastly, thinking about perestroika, science against sort of quantitative dominance within political science journals. And out of that came a really important book by Ann Norton called 99 Theses on Political Methods. And I'm wondering if in the first chapter or in the introduction you really need to make that argument anymore against quantitative, the divide of qualitative versus quantitative studies.
Yes, in the back.
Maybe this is for Eric. I haven't read your book, but I know that in Indonesia there's kind of a group of young intellectuals who don't like to be talked about. I mean, they don't like kind of Western come to Indonesia and write about Indonesia and then talk about Indonesia, divide Indonesia, and then teach Indonesian how to see and perceive Indonesia. I don't know how far that kind of issue taken into consideration.
Excellent. Are there any other graduate students or faculty or visitors that might want to make any comments or have any questions?
We get a shot at the last remark.
Yeah, I think what we'll do maybe is give people who feel moved to speak the opportunity to speak. We have about 10 minutes left, so just keeping in mind how much time we have, and maybe addressing what you feel is most relevant to the questions and comments that have been posed. And maybe we could start down here and then move our way to Eric.
I'm not going to say anything to Lindy's question because I think we understand the problems there, but I want to speak particularly to your question. It's a great issue. It's one that I think, you know, I try to talk about. We don't have that kind of enough people from the region. It's a problem, like Rick was saying. Why is it? It's questions of language, it's kind of cultural attitudes and so on. But the more criticism that comes, the more people who say, no, that's not how it is, the better, in my view. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I think that one of the issues here is where collaboration between at least U.S. and Southeast Asian scholars is really important. And to that regard, I want to kind of, praise the Journal Explorations for the kinds of things that you guys are starting to do to learn from each other. That's really quite significant. Second point is fighting is good. Fighting is really important. It's really constructive, obviously within certain parameters, to engage in debate about these issues. That's the way you learn, by being challenged. I wanted to mention something also. Somebody raised, there's this question about, well, can you're challenged if you're trying to generalize on the basis of something that you're not sure of. And again, that you don't have tremendous deep contextual knowledge in. And again, I think that this tends to be too polarized a view. One of the things that I've tried to do is make use of what are called shadow cases, is that I have cases in the work that I've done that I know quite well. I think I know better than anybody else around. And at the same time, if those things are right, then I should see the general patterns that I'm teasing out from that case reflected in other cases in the secondary material. Doesn't mean that it's, you know, totally superficial. It's not as deep as my primary case. But shadow cases are very useful. They may not tell you everything, but I think they're important. And the last point is how is this question of getting qualitative scholars ready to engage with quantitative colleagues. And I want to, as some of you know, there are more and more writings, articles on these multi-method things. So somebody will say in my department, compare two cases on the regression line. Well, a couple of years ago, I didn't even know what a regression line was, frankly. But now I know what it is, and I understand. I can say, wait a minute, I would rather compare a case that's on the regression line that's off the regression line. Mm-hmm. And that actually is quite useful, and I can respond to them in that way. But the main thing that it does, and I think this is kind of what the gentleman's point about Geddes and other people, is that you ought to be transparent. You could be totally wrong. So what I disagree with you to some degree, Peter, in terms of Scotchpole, is she may have been wrong, but it's clear why she was wrong. It's very clear what she was doing. It's all out there for everybody to see. And so we know we're going to be wrong. That's always going to happen. So the question is, do you build on your mistakes, and are your mistakes obvious for everybody to see?
You're very generous to Scotchpole, which is okay.
Well, I think proof is in the pudding.
It left a very bad legacy among a lot of people. I mean, who barked off on a neo-positivism quest that was just absolutely empty of content.
Well, I think there she... Okay, we got
it. But anyway, yeah. But
okay.
Pursuing one of the other points was raised in the back of the room, though. I would make the aggressively strong argument that if the outsider does good qualitative work, then he becomes an insider. And then he may be in a better position to give an account of what's going on because he's not going to be blinded by the same biases of the insider. I mean, but of course, the assumption I'm making there is that the outsider has done good qualitative work so that he becomes an insider. Whereas, in other words, he has a mastery of the meanings and use and understand what's going on in that community as well as the insider does. He is then in a better position, it seems to me, to do social theory because he's now in a position to free himself from the biases of that local community.
Yeah.
let me make one further comment on history as well, which I think make a strong, again, more radical position than you're forcing me to. All human science is ideographic. All of it is ideographic. There's no escaping the fact that, that human institutions and human actions and human societies are unique and in the concrete particular. And to give an account of that is not to look for the general laws which explain them. In other words, the positivist conception of a general law to explain phenomena just doesn't work in the human science. It doesn't work in the natural sciences either, but I'm not going to make that argument right now. The difference between historians, though, and social scientists more generally is that historians tend to state a causal narratives which involve agents but not social mechanisms. Whereas social scientists, I want to argue, must look for agents as causes but must also then look for social mechanisms as causes. So, for example, it would be important to have an understanding of the mechanism which generates slums in the third world. What makes this development of slums what it is today, unlike what it was 100 years ago? That's something a historian may not want to do, because that's going to involve some political economy and some structural analysis and some stuff that's not going to be his cup of tea. But I think in general, that social scientist, before he finishes, I'm thinking here of Mike Davis' stuff, obviously. Before that social scientist finishes, he's going to have to do some history. No way to escape that either. No way to escape that. That's the strongest position I want to take. Quickly to Ben, I think Ben is quite right. My own experience has been that my books are well received in Europe and other parts of the world, but not in America, because American social scientists are all positivists.
Not all of them, hopefully. I have nothing further to say. We'll let Harry talk about this.
I want to address a few points, both from the panel and also from the audience. I just want to make clear that the project, the book, is not in any sense an attack on quantitative methods or anything like that. There's no attempt to denigrate. You know, we're all in favor of pluralistic methodology approaches, but it is an effort first to assert the value of these of qualitative methods. And to Rick's points, I think he's articulated them much better than I have. The issue here is really rigor in terms of systematizing the language, the vocabulary, the process of the kind of research we do, particularly in qualitative methods. And it's especially important for those who do qualitative research, because it's just more prone, given the fact that it's not involved in the precision of numbers, it's more prone to these attacks. So the issue of systematizing it, I think, is very important. And that's one thing we've tried to do here in some way by actually structuring the chapters in thematic ways. Now, on the issue, again, that Rick raised about multi-methods, this is an important issue that I think all political scientists, social scientists have to grapple with now. This is really a trend in which we're moving with methodology. I have very mixed feelings about this, because on one hand, I think it is useful. I think it's important to know a range of methodological tools and use them when necessary, given the problem you're trying to address. But I also think that that part of this is really just sort of, again, an issue of fads and trends. And we're back to sort of David Layden's tripartite form modeling, quantitative, and a narrative, and a case study. And what happens in this kind of thinking is that the qualitative work sort of becomes a subset of the formal model, and it becomes subsumed under this formal modeling. So in that sense, if the issue is simply to follow a fad and follow formal modeling, then use a narrative, as David Layden would like to do, as a buttress for the formal model, then I'm opposed to that. But if it is an issue of actually finding the right tools when they are necessary for the problem at hand, then I think multi-methods approach is in fact useful.
Well, but then it seems you have to qualify your tolerance of pluralism as well. I mean, in other words, a methodological pluralist would say, "Oh, that's okay," but it isn't okay. The point is that the formal model is useless.
Well,
it's not worth anything.
I'm not at all a fan of.
And the quantitative methods are useful, but they're not useful explanations.
I mean, I think the issue is, what is the question you're trying to answer? To what extent does the problem necessitate particular methodology? I think that's really the issue. My big issue is not fitting the method simply because you want to, be faddish for the particular problem. Only if the problem necessitates a method is it legitimate. That's where I think I'm in favor of this kind of pluralism. That's the way I define it.
You're again very generous man.
Well,
that's lovely.
It's I mean, we're up here for dialogue.
I'm not so generous.
Well, You're more of a veteran.
Good. Fight.
I am. Last minute, I want to address again two last points, and they're both that Rick has raised. Latin America's comparison to Southeast Asia is very interesting, and it is true. If you think of theories coming or concepts coming out of Latin America, the bureaucratic polity model, democratic transitions, the work of Guillermo O'Donnell and many others, Lawrence Whitehead, has been very important. Why have they been more prominent in theory building Southeast Asianists? I'm not sure that the issue is industrialization in Latin America, ups and downs versus Southeast Asia. I think there is an issue of thinking of Latin America, whether right or wrong, as a homogeneous unit, largely because of language, and because of that you have a larger end there, more than Southeast Asia, you can think of it as a homogeneous unit, and from there you can theorize, and because there's lots of historical links to Western Europe, you can make that stick. Whether empirically the theorization is correct is up for grabs, but at least it gives them more confidence in doing that compared to Southeast Asianists, where we grapple more with language diversity, and that restrains us, for right or wrong, in terms of making broader generalizations. And the very last point I want to make, again, Rick's point, a very provocative point, and I remember this very well at the workshop about proper nouns and the uproar that it raised then. You know, I think on some level Rick is correct that taking out proper nouns allows one to think, what is this a case of? And that is really an issue of framing, really framing theoretically, framing more abstract terms. And when I studied at Penn as an undergrad, I studied with Fred Fry, who was very much, he wrote an article in Comparative Politics about, in fact, taking out the proper nouns from our research. And yet I wrote a whole thesis of comparative historical analysis on East Asia. But what I learned from him was that what matters is thinking theoretically. And I think what Rick is trying to push is that, I think he's doing it perhaps excessively, but to be provocative, is that it helps at least initially in taking out the proper nouns so that you situate your work in a broader comparative canvas, but not necessarily being immune to the actual empirical processes, but at least in the very beginning, in the origins of framing, which is really crucial, thinking in broader terms, which also goes to the point raised here about using Virgil in works on Vietnam, thinking more in terms of breadth and comparative analysis helps one to situate one's work in a more theoretical vein.
All right. Well, we've had, I think, a very dynamic discussion in some ways. Maybe we close with a... I thought Rick Doner's comment about fighting is good was a provocative comment, too. But, you know, what I try to say to my graduate students is always be engaging something or someone, you know, whether it's ideas or particular kinds of notions. And I think it was Don Emerson who once told me, you know, the worst of all fates is to be hung in obscurity, right? And so, you know, that's one thing to kind of think about as well. But with that, I want to thank all of the panelists and speakers. I highly encourage you to now think about purchasing and reading this book and to think further about the issues that were raised here. So thank you all.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. The center's director is Professor Barbara Watson Andaya. The associate director is Paul Rausch. The Brown Bag series is coordinated by Hua Lei, and the podcast series is produced by Christian Razukas. Your announcer is Nozia Azmi. This is a free service made possible by the center, the University of Hawaii, and the United States Department of Education. For more podcasts, videos, and information about Southeast Asia, visit our website at hawaii.edu/CSEAS.